Listener production.
Shares.
Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is the Motley Fool Money Mailbag.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, our very special Sunday mailbag edition. I'm Scott Phillips from The Motley Fool. He is the man, the myth, the legend, the bloke who started the whole thing, the billion-dollar valued strawman.com, Mr. Page. Good morning.
I wish. Yeah, good morning. How are you going?
Very well, and you?
Yeah, good. Good. Not at the billionaire status yet, but, you know, it's good to have goals.
Hey, look, close enough is good enough, I reckon. mate, you've obviously finished your triathlon this morning.
Oh, you know it, yeah. No. I squeezed two in, actually, this morning, so.
You're a busy man.
It was a good day, yeah.
You're a busy man, only an hour and a half, too. I don't know how you do it.
So far.
Mate, let's get straight into the questions from our listeners. This is interesting, mate. I'll be interested in your thoughts on this. Simon says, "Hey, Scott, and the hey bloke. Love the podcast. I've been listening every weekend since Andrew was on it the first time around. Great discussions and wise advice on investing." Thank you, mate. "At the risk of more rants on housing," Simon starts.
Oh, no.
"I think Andrew has missed the point on home loans."
Okay.
Let's try this
one. Very, very good chances.
In capital letters, he says, "Borrow as much as you can, for as long as you can with your home loan, but pay it down quicker." And there ends the capitalization. "I get the amount involved seems huge," says Simon, "but over the years, your house will go up in value. Your income will go up, but your loan and payments are locked in at today's values and may even fall a bit when rates fall. A 30-year mortgage term is great, but you're not obliged to take 30 years to pay it off. Indeed, you should put every spare dollar, bonus, windfall, or inheritance into the loan, which will substantially reduce the time needed to pay it off. Every dollar put into the loan is making you save 6 to 7% tax-free compared with putting it in a savings account. It's a great place to keep your spare cash. But don't actually pay the loan off," says Simon. "Keep it open with just a few thousand dollars owing and minimal payments. Why? Because you get older or retire, your ability to borrow falls off dramatically. Just try getting a credit card once you have retired. It sucks," he says. "Luckily, with a variable rate loan with redraw, you effectively have a huge overdraft. You can call on it any time. An unexpected expense, kitchen reno, new car, you have the access to your excess payments with no paperwork, loan approvals, or bank fees. And for the experienced investor," says Simon, "it's a cheaper source of funding than a margin loan when major opportunities arise, such as the COVID crash of 2020. If you pull some of your excess payments and can earn more than the interest rate, you have the opportunity to set up a positively geared investment. Having a potential commitment to pay off a mortgage into your 70s is far more comforting than paying your unpredictable and ever-rising rents until you die. So," says Simon, "borrow more than you need for as long as you can, but pay it down early, and you'll be far more comfortable financially in life and have the security of a home to live in. Do you agree?" Question mark. Full on, Simon. So I think Simon's taking exception to your views that maybe renting forever is better than owning your house. Is Simon now right? Is he wrong? Is he missing the point?
I think I've very, very much walked away from the renting forever angle. If that hasn't been made clear. The short version of it is that mathematically it makes a great deal of sense, but given the insecurity you have as a renter, it doesn't. You know, the kind of things that matter that don't fit into a spreadsheet.
The life stuff, yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know. I really do get misunderstood, I think, a lot. You know, I think no one's arguing against the value of a house, right? Yeah. Like, of course it's got value. We'll always have value. We'll always be in demand. I think on average, over very long stretches of time, and it'll hold their value really well also. I just think that everything that Simon said was correct, but there was a couple of big assumptions baked into the scenario. And these assumptions may prove to be very valid assumptions, but they are assumptions. And that is that the price of the house will always go up. And I also think, too, it's just sort of like, well, throw everything you can at. I mean, people are already doing that. I mean, who's paying 40% deposits? No one, right? Like, it's sort of, it works until it doesn't. I mean, I could equally say, why wouldn't you just undertake a highly leveraged FX trading strategy on the Japanese-USD pair?
Yeah.
And look, if you had just done this over the last 30 years, you would have made $1 squillion. Right. Like, it's just, you know, in terms of opportunity cost, it's just vastly superior. Well, maybe it is if all of these scenarios hold true. So I think wherever I've urged having what might be considered a lazy balance sheet and over emphasizing sort of providing a bigger buffer for yourself. Mm-hmm. It's just for the just in case. It's not predicated on the world is definitely going to end. Yeah. But I just think we've got a whole generation of people who never experienced a downturn. And whether it's shares or fine art or bottles of collectible wine or whatever it is, these things happen. And so Simon also said for the sophisticated investor. So I think if you've got a very good earnings capacity and you've got the ability to service your loan comfortably, you know, with a little bit of buffer, and you've got access to use the collateral in your house for productive uses or even things that you may want to treat yourself without extending yourself too much. Yeah, 100%. Like there's absolutely no disagreement there whatsoever. In fact, I would even add to it. I'd say you're borrowing in a currency that's deflating. Like go short the Aussie dollar and put it into something hard, like a property, right? So it does make a great deal of sense. And where I guess any argument would be, if there is an argument, it's just the degree to how close each person may choose to move the slider towards more aggressive to more conservative. And here's the thing. In hindsight, we'll know. If things just continue to go up forever, the answer is be as aggressive as you can. If things are about to fall in a heap, then you should be ultra conservative. Well, we don't know. Mm. And another thing that, you know, sophisticated investors should understand is that things go in cycles, markets are unpredictable. That is the lesson of investing writ large, right? It's like if it was easy, we'd all be billionaires. It's not. And it's extraordinarily difficult to forecast the, you know, to look through the goat entrails and the tea leaves to figure out where businesses and economies and asset classes are all going. So I feel it's a little bit wherever I've sort of advocated for anything that's going to, I know, sound pretty bearish. It's just to sort of say, you know, knock yourself out, have some fun, invest in the way that you feel is most appropriate to you. But investing is synonymous with risk by definition, right? Like, and there's different degrees of risk. And when it comes to property, the use of leverage can make it a very low risk investment or an extraordinarily high risk investment. Mm. So I'll only debate the point at where the slider sits. For me, it's going to always sit in an under optimized way from a purely financial lens because of the emotional factor to it. And that's just me. It's not right or well, it's right. It's perfectly right. You can't argue against it because that's for me. And Simon might have a different tolerance. And then, well, that's right for you. Just go in eyes wide open to any scenario where leverage is at play is the only point I'm making.
I think it's a really good point. I think it's right. Simon, my only thoughts, a couple of them, and as I've said a million times, there's the old Yogi Berra quote is wonderful about, in theory, there's no difference between theory and practice, but in practice there is. Holding an offset account or redraw so you can use the money if you need to becomes for many people, too many people, if I want to. And so all this money you've paid down, think you're getting ahead, you then subsequently redraw and use for something else, and you're back at square one again. Which, again, so are you wrong? No. Are you right for everybody? No. And generally speaking, again, I've said a million times, 90% of us think we're above average drivers, right? That's the problem. So I'll use it well. That guy over there won't. He says the same about you. Someone's going to be wrong. And maybe you're not that person. I'm not coming to you, Simon. But in terms of advice for our listeners, I'm generally a kind of, you're talking about lazy balance sheet, Ram. I take the same from a psychological perspective, which is, you know, I don't mind missing out on the last percentage point or two if it means I can take a whole lot of risk off the table. If I can pay off a loan, I don't have the redraw available, but I then can't redraw the money and use it for something stupid and the house, the loan's paid off. So again, Simon, I'm not saying you're wrong. Similarly with a credit card, you know, a Pollyanna of me and a bit, you know, OTT of me to say, well, maybe try and get to a point in retirement where you don't need a credit card, rather than saying, let's leave a load open so I can get the money if I want to get the money. What's right for everyone is right for everyone. As a general piece of advice, I think if your toes are on the line, you're too close to the line. If you're not sure where it is, you're too close to the line. I'd rather be able to see it clearly from where I am and be far enough back from it that I'm not relying on the vicissitudes of fortune to make me successful or unsuccessful or better off or worse off. When I say fortune, I even mean my own inabilities. You know, if I decide tomorrow to go and buy a new car with the offset, well, you know, I've probably misused it, even though I had great intentions for the last 15 years before that. I think sometimes just getting out of your own way. Psychologists call it pre-commitment bias. Just putting yourself in a position where you can't trip yourself up and actually set yourself up so you can't trip yourself up is probably the way I'd approach it. But again, mate, if it's right for you, it's right for you.
I mean, mathematically, the right answer is I'm an allocator of capital. I've got, as a homeowner, I've got access to this capital that I can draw against.
Yep.
It's going to cost me to do that. But wherever I can get a higher rate of return with confidence is a rational decision.
Yes.
So, you know, when you're in the classroom, that's the theory, and it's right. It's watertight.
Yes.
But, you know, how many businesses, investors don't get the return that they kind of expect? And not for any fault of their own, for things that could have or should have easily been seen. It's what markets do, right?
Yeah.
I was sitting on a 30% compound annual return on my straw man scorecard.
Nice.
Back in 2021. Yeah, no, well, hear me out. it's 14% or something now, but it's the last couple of years have not been kind to me. You get to that moment of hubris, that pride before fall moment,
yeah.
Right? Where it's sort of like in any asset class, I think, where the dangers of strong periods of performance is it builds a hubris in you and it builds it blinds you to the downside. And it's just always something good to have reminded to you that, you know, sometimes you just get hit by, you know, broadside by something completely unexpected, and that's the only caution here.
I think that's pretty good advice. Here's a question from Craig on a very different topic. Hi Scott and Ram, I hope Andrew has recovered from his marathon ocean swim this morning. So Craig, that was probably true when you wrote the email, but of course, as we now know, he's had two triathlons this morning. But, you know, the concept is still right.
Ocean swim is next week. Yeah.
I hope you can help me to square a few circles, says Craig, on what happens on a company's ex-dividend date, please. Firstly, the share price at the open on the ex-dividend date is usually reduced by the dividend value. I understand this helps to stop people from taking advantage of receiving the dividend payment and selling their shares to profit from this. But who or what sets this price? Does it happen automatically? Or is there somebody that makes this happen?
Secondly,
if a share price is an indication of a company's total future earnings, why is this affected on the ex-dividend date by paying out a share of current profits? And thirdly, if everyone knows that the share price will fall on the ex-dividend date, why isn't this already priced in by investors? And lastly, if the share price is reduced by the dividend amount for a given company, why don't the indices such as the All Ords and the ASX 200 include dividend payments? I'm sure there's a logical explanation, but I can't get my head around it. Thanks, guys. Listening to you on the pod machine, nice, Craig, is one of the highlights of my week. Cheers, Craig. Ram, tell us all about ex-dividend dates, mate.
Oh, God, that was such a great question. You're going to have to remind me of the various points. But so the ex-dividend date is the date after which any purchaser of the shares is not entitled to the next dividend, the dividend that's already been announced, the upcoming dividend.
Mm-hmm.
So if I buy it before the close of trade, before the ex-dividend date, I get my ownership, my proportional ownership in the company, and I also get to claim the dividend that's associated with each of those shares. If I buy it the next day, I don't. It's as simple as that. There are other dates you might see. You might see a record date thrown around, and you might also see a payment date. Payment date's obvious. That's the day that you actually the money hits your bank account, or if you're still living in 1922, you get your check in the mail, or at least gets mailed out. And the record date is the date at which it doesn't really matter for investors. It's the date by which it must be sort of all of the paperwork is essentially done by the registry. What matters is the ex date and then the pay date. Well, can I get to the interesting part though?
Yeah,
this is who decides that? And there's this wonderful thing that it's the same thing that decides prices in any open and fair market, which is the market itself. And it's a thing of beauty. It just relies purely on the motivated self-interest of all the participants. So why does the price adjust? Because at large, you've got a rational market who looks at it and goes, well, yesterday I got the dividend, today I don't. So it's easy. Like whatever the company is worth, it's clearly worth that much less, all else being equal. Of course, this is the other thing. Don't expect it to change by the dividend amount. There are plenty of times where a company goes ex-dividend and the share price goes up, or it goes down by more than the dividend amount, because there are always other factors at play. But it is the one constant that will always sort of be adjusted. And again, the important point being all else being equal, it will drop by the dividend amount. And it just makes perfect sense, because think about what would you prefer? It's Thursday today, you get to buy it and have a cash payment in a little while, or you buy it tomorrow and you don't get the cash payment, but you still get the share. It's like, just take off the difference and then we're all square. Did I do that justice?
I think so, mate. I think so. I'll just kind of go back, because I've got the question in front of me, which makes my life easier than yours. It happens automatically, Craig, but not because anyone says the price must change. The market's pretty inefficient often, but really, really efficient when it knows the money's going away. So if you're going to pay a dollar for a share on Friday with a 5 cent dividend, and then on Monday the dividend is no longer available, if you know that the dollar you're spending on Friday is effectively 95 cents worth of business value and 5 cents worth of cash, because you know you're getting the dividend, then on Monday when the cash is no longer available to you, the same math should say the price will fall by that amount. So it's not automatic, it's not guaranteed, it's not mandated, it's not calculated. It's just the market saying, well, if I thought it was worth something on Monday, on Friday, sorry, I think it's worth that much less on Monday because the dividend.
Actually, here's the way to look at it. Think about it, what happens after the payment date. Both, there's one you bought before the X date, I bought after the X date.
Yeah, that's right.
After the payment date, you've got a share, I've got a share.
Yep.
You've just also got a dividend. Now, you paid more for your share, but you've also got a dividend. So they net themselves off and we're both in the same position again.
That's right. On Friday, I bought 95 cents worth of business and 5 cents worth of dividend. On Monday, you're only buying 95 cents worth of business because the dividend is no longer available. So the price just falls.
I think that's
perfect. Why it's not priced in, Craig, is basically because you don't want to price it in because you want the dividend. So it is priced in effectively, but in the sense that the value is already incorporated. So it's priced in perfectly on both days, or not perfectly, it's probably the wrong word, but pretty efficiently on both days because of that difference that Andrew's talked about.
If you wanted to think about it as a big, long, just say you had some omnipotence and you could do an accurate DCF, a discounted cash flow, and you could plot out the company's earnings from here to kingdom come, and you were to then do it on the day before the X date and the day of the X date, you'll find that it won't make much difference. Yeah, but it is kind of priced in that kind of sense because, yes, while there's that dividend amount is real now, as a component of a very long tail, hopefully, of dividends, depending on what forecasts you're using or what numbers you're using, it is going to adjust by the same amount anyway. So the math actually does work out pretty perfectly.
I think the last thing is the price, including the dividends on the indices. They should.
Oh, that's a good one.
They really should.
They do. They you've got to dig for them. Yeah. You've got to dig for them.
It's very, very hard to find and no one ever quotes it. And it's messy for those reasons. It is one of the, other than per capita GDP, which we talked about on Friday, quoting an index without share prices is just, without dividends is just stupid. There is no logical reason to do it that way at all that I can think of, Ram. It makes no difference.
No, it's like having an investment property and not factoring in the rent.
Right. I mean, on a daily basis, you might say, well, you're not getting a rent between Monday and Tuesday, so the value of the property goes up or down by 0.5%, and you don't need to include the dividend over that short period of time. So if you see, Monday's share price or Monday's market value on the news, and then you see Tuesday's on the news, the difference in those is going to be the same in both cases. But over any extended period of time, and particularly over dividend season, it matters a lot. And in fact, you'll often hear and see people say, well, the market fell so much today, but BHP went ex dividend, and so did CSL. Because the falls in their share prices, as you've already talked about, Craig, with the reduction, actually really does impact the market value as measured by just the share price alone. There is zero reason for it. Even maybe in the old days it was doable. It was done because you couldn't easily capture all the dividends. I mean, imagine a market in 1922, as you mentioned before, Ram, when checks were being sent out. You could get a report to show the closing prices of all the company's share prices, right? That would be easy. But if you had to track over time who's paid what dividend to who, that's harder, right? It's harder. It's easier to do a point in time and say, we're recording this on the 7th of March, let's make it today. On the 7th of March, the company's share prices were X. On the 8th of March, they're Y. On the 9th of March, they're Z, and so on and so forth. It's harder to kind of go, that company paid a dividend out, so I've got to put that in. I mean, if you're calculating it on paper or with a slide rule, much harder to keep track of. In this day and age, when everything, and as Ram said, you can get this index, it's just common usage that stops us from actually doing it more accurately. And we've said lots of times when people say the market finally hit a new high today, it's almost certain to hit a new high 6 or 12 months earlier because the dividends aren't being included and they should be because, as you say, mate, same as rent on a property.
Yep.
Hey, question from Jamie, who starts by saying, hi, Scott, and Ram Chop, which is a new one. I do like our listeners' imaginations when it comes to names. A while ago, a listener asked a question about how to use the share advisor service, mainly about whether to buy every recommendation or which one of the recommendations to buy. The answer you gave was essentially to buy the best idea. My portfolio consists of ETFs, listed investment companies, and a, quote, regular company with the plan to research and add some more with the help of share advisor and this podcast for ideas, says Jamie. How would you go about determining what offers the most attractive price and what is the best idea at any point in time in a way that's a fair comparison between regular companies, LICs, listed investment companies, and ETFs. The scenario I'm trying to get my head around is this. Say I only have enough money to buy one lot of shares right now. I have three ideas what I'd like to invest in. For example, let's say I like the look of Domino's, Soul Patts, and some ETF. How could I fairly compare the value of each? I understand how to value a company by getting earnings or cash flow, discounting that over the future, taking into account the desired level of return, range of values for growth, applying marginal safety, and then comparing that to the current price to see whether it's good value. That's a very good start. Well done, mate. But how would you go about valuing an LIC or an ETF when the underlying value doesn't necessarily come from the cash generated from selling a product or service, but rather from the assets it holds? Do future discounted earnings apply to LICs? What about an ETF? I don't think I've ever heard you mention valuing ETFs. Is it just the premium or discount on the underlying assets? If your answer is to research and evaluate all the holdings being held by an LIC or ETF, then why bother buying and recommending them? Why not just pick the best idea that they hold if you suggest going to that effort? How would you then compare this to companies selling products or services? He says, and before Ram rejects the premise of the question, I reject the premise of the answer. Thanks for the podcast, full on. Jamie, Ram, you have been you've been cut off at the pass on that one. You can't reject the premise because Jamie's already rejected the premise of the answer. What do you reckon, mate? How does that work?
He's answered it. Yeah, I mean, the only way to do it is to well, let's start with companies. You come up with a fair value, an intrinsic value, if you like. Mm-hmm. You assume that it's correct. It's probably not. And that's not a criticism on you.
That's right. Yeah.
It's a guess. But you know, you have to do it. You come up with a guess. Company A might be maybe at a 10% premium to your idea of fair value. Company B may be 10% below. And there's the choice. Or, you know, maybe one's like 15% below. And, you know, all else being equal, those wonderful series of words, you go for the one with the biggest discount. That's how you would do it. And if you wanted to then do that analysis against an ETF, unfortunately, you just got to go through every single company in there and do it and come up with some way to weight the discount to fair value. And no one does it. No one can do it. I mean, ETFs rest entirely on the principle that the market at large will more or less get it right over time. And so you're deliberately going with that structure to sort of say, I'll just take the average because I don't know what's going to be the best. I mean, I hear the point of, well, why not just pick the best stocks in the index? Like, well, let me know what they are, like, and I'll back up the truck. Because none of us, I mean, we've all got our theories, and you know, we've all made our bets, but none of us really know. So, it's just, I think in the scenario that is outlined, when you've got a compelling regular company in front of you that you feels that you want to own, and it's a good discount to fair value, and it looks like it'll fit well amongst all your other investments, go for it. And at other times you'll be looking around, it's like, there's really nothing that excites me either through the quality or the value. And it's like, no, I'll just go, and I've got some spare cash, I'll go the ETF. Mm. It's a lovely sort of, I don't know, if you want to call it a staging area for your capital, right? Until something better comes along. And that is always the way I think you've got to look at portfolio management, is that, you know, you want to field the best players at any one point in time. And the best opportunity set today in March of 2024 will be different to what it is in March of 2025. So you will adjust and do things over time, and new money will come in. But it's always the question of what looks best now. And if nothing looks best, obviously now, then, or you just, you haven't reached a point where you can make that informed judgment, the ETF is the easy answer.
I think you answered it beautifully, mate. I'll give a slightly different angle for the same answer, but end up at the same place. I would suggest to you, Jamie, that ETFs are not the sort of things you would buy compared to companies almost ever. You're buying ETF for different reasons, in my view, because the reality is, if the ETF is cheap enough, an ETF can't be cheaper than the cheapest company in the index by definition, because it's an average. It's a total and it's an average, right? So if the ETF looks inexpensive, or let's say it looks cheap, and let's say we could do the maths, you can't, but we'll work with you. You can if you add them up individually, as Ram says, but let's do it. Let's hypothesize you've done that work. And you've worked out the ETF looks cheap. Now, it can only look cheap if some of the companies in that ETF are cheap, in which case, by the time you've done that work, you know which company it is and you buy that company instead. So it's almost impossible. I would say it is impossible. If you're buying in the same market, and I'll get to why it would be different. If you're buying in the same market, It's impossible to for an ASX 200 ETF to be the cheapest option available to you because averages are averages. And it's an average by definition. So if there's only one company that's cheaper than the average, there has to be at least one. If everything else was exactly average, one was above and one was below, then there'd at least be one company worth buying instead of the index, if that's what you wanted to do. And so you wouldn't buy the ETF based on its relative valuation. You couldn't rationally, logically, theoretically in that case.
Sorry to interject. You could make very broad level kind of bets on the overall quote unquote expensiveness of the market. If you look at the average PE, we know for the market is usually around 16 or so. If we happen to be in an environment where it's at 30 for whatever reason, you might think, okay, on average, the market is more expensive. But that's about as good as you can get.
Perfectly put. Yeah, and that's exactly right. So why are you going to buy an ETF? Well, you're going to buy an ETF because you want passive exposure, or you want broad diversification without having to buy them all yourself. Or you haven't got the time to value the companies, or you're not sure about the value of the companies you want as dollar cost average. I have ETFs for my young bloke. I've said this before in one of the accounts we set up for him, because we wanted to sit there and compound away for years, and that's just what we wanted to do. In my own account, I've got ETFs for, and this is where it's different, for overseas markets, and that's where you might do something different. I'll get back to that. But otherwise, individual shares. I would have no issue with anyone listening now only having an ETF portfolio, or only stocks, or a combination of both. You just have to know what you were doing. If you're going to add ETFs plus stocks, you'd be saying, I want ETFs for broad diversification and ballast in my portfolio. And I'm dollar cost averaging. I'm going to add, as it sounds like you might be, Jamie, and we can't give you personal advice, but you might sell and I'll add a couple of companies from when they look attractive. And you absolutely would. But you could never mathematically choose an ASX 200 ETF over a component part of the ASX 200. What I have done, and what I've recommended to our members, is a couple of international ETFs from time to time. And I'm going to say outright, here's where you need to kind of take half a step back from perfection. I say this to the team all the time. When we last recommended an ASX, I think it was, S&P 500 ETF, I think we recommended. And it was impossible for that to be better value than any stock we could find in the ASX. There must have been at least one stock in the ASX better value. Just because, again, I've talked about the average before, right? Similarly, there'd be better stocks on the US market in particular. So why do we recommend, if our job is to find the best idea, why do we recommend that ETF if there was a chance, and a very, very high likelihood, something on the ASX was cheaper? And the answer was, we believe it's in our members' best interests in general, not personally, but in general, to have exposure to the US market and international markets for the reasons of diversification and growth and everything else we've talked about in the past. And so that's literally why we did it. So we had exactly the conversation you're thinking about, Jamie. And the answer for us was, we talk about this regularly, and we think about, there's almost a sort of a short list of ETFs always on our conversation every month, where we say, is now the right time to recommend another ETF? And we always say it's never going to be the best idea, financially, mathematically. If you did a DCF or everything, it's almost impossible for it to be the best idea. But it can be the best idea from a portfolio construction perspective, from a diversification perspective, from the right way to build a dollar cost averaged long-term portfolio. It can be the best idea because you want to add exposure, in my view, to the US markets regularly. So that's kind of answering out of both sides of my mouth, mate, but that's a very real example of exactly what you're going through, because exactly what we went through at the same time to try and work out exactly that. So it's also, by the way, why I really dislike thematic ETFs for the reasons you've highlighted in terms of not going through and valuing every individual company. How do you say lithium looks good, or cybersecurity looks good, or gold looks good, or Bitcoin looks good, or whatever, just because you go, well, it kind of thematically sounds okay, and so maybe I should just buy the ETF instead of actually doing the work. If you're not going to do the work, buy a passive ETF. Buying an active ETF without doing the work is the worst of both worlds in my mind. You might get it right because you get lucky, but if you haven't done the work to value it and you're not getting passive low cost exposure to a whole index, I really reckon that's trying to cross a chasm with two short jumps. You just can't do it.
Yep.
I made one for from Jack. I like this one. Hi, Scott and Andrew. Greetings from Geraldton, WA. Nice. I'm 28 years old, bastard. And about a year ago, I went for a trip to Argentina. Everything I know about inflation is either theory or watching the Australian inflation rate increase a few percent. But at the time, Argentina had an inflation rate of about 100%. People were spending a lot because if they held onto it, it would become worthless anyway. My question is, as much as we talk bad about the Aussie government and the cost of living, do they deserve some sort of a bravo for the economy not getting as bad as other countries like Argentina? Or is it as basic as that we simply had a stronger economy to begin with less corruption? Many thanks, Jack. I'm going to go first on this question. One, mate, if you don't mind. Only because
please, yeah.
I'm no expert on macroeconomics or long-term economic history, but I am fascinated by it. I'm a pretty keen student of history. I read a book, and it's an economic history book, and I can't remember its name. It's literally something like The Economic History of Australia or something. I can't remember. Anyway, early 1900s, the Australian and Argentinian economies looked almost identical. In terms of their makeup, in terms of wealth levels, the complexity or otherwise of the sectors that made up the economy, the sorts of things, big beef industry in both countries, they looked really, really similar.
Can I just very quick interjection? 100 years ago, Argentina was the richest country in the world per capita.
There you go.
And Australia was way up there as well.
Yeah. There you go.
Very, 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 very well endowed country, and a lot of wealth. When you go there, you see some beautiful old architecture that was built back in the day when they were super rich as a country. Sorry, go on.
No, it's great. So that is a great setup, right? So, you know, you kind of think sliding doors, right? You know, which if you'd been able to choose one at that point, you might have chosen Argentina or you might have chosen Australia, but they weren't that dissimilar. And then, as the economies continued to develop, they developed really, really differently. Honestly, Jack, my understanding of it, again, I claim no absolute expertise, and if there are any economic historians listening, firstly, go and do something else, but secondly, if you have a view, feel free to throw it at us. It came down to, in this author's view, the institutions in the different economies, the way those institutions worked together to deliver the society that we have. And it's a worthwhile, I think it's a very, very worthwhile thing to remember. I'm not going to say Australia is necessarily better, although the numbers would suggest we have been, and I'm not claiming no nationalistic, patriotic benefit, credit out of that, because I wasn't around and you weren't around and no one was around. Things evolved, and they evolved differently. And there, for the grace of God, frankly, go we. We could be Argentina, they could be Australia right now. They're not, we're not, and we should be very, very thankful for that. I will quickly jump on the soapbox and say it is why the defense of our institutions is so incredibly, incredibly important. If you take those for granted, if you let them get eroded, then you become Argentina. Yep. Is it corruption directly? I don't know that it's corruption. It probably is, I would speculate. But it doesn't need to be. Just the institutions that allow for the thriving of an economy, that allow for, it's a bit of compounding, but it's better than compounding because it's kind of the interplay, right? I compound mine, Andrew compounds his, but we do it by compounding each other's. I deal with him, he deals with me. The ability to trade, to cooperate, to trust. And when I say trust, I don't necessarily mean implicitly. I actually mean explicitly in terms of the government structures, you know, the legal systems, the currency, all those things that happen that give businesses confidence to grow. We take them for granted a bit. And I think when people say, oh, capitalism sucks, it's not working for us, maybe socialism or communism would be better, all that kind of thing, I get the sense that people feel underserved by the current system, and I get the feeling that maybe a utopian alternative might be better. There are those who say less regulation would be better. Again, possibly right, but I would also suggest that Argentinians, if they could go back to 1900 and say, can we have Australia's institutions, please, and then see what happens, you have a very, very different future. So, mate, you're right. I think you've absolutely nailed it. We didn't have a stronger economy, but we did have much, much stronger, more cohesive institutions. And that, from most reports, seems to have made the difference. Ram?
I'm going to 100% agree with you. Like, it is. Exactly. But I'll be more specific. It's the money, stupid. It's the money. So the money, the Argent... What is the Argentinian... Is it the peso?
Peso. Argentinian peso, yeah.
Right. Is a shared fiction that works very well, except it wasn't managed very well. You know, so basically you had and corruption is mixed into it, but institutional rigor is perhaps the better way to sort of put it. You had these things evolve, as you say, over long periods of time. And it's just like, you know, the government spent well beyond its means. Mm-hmm. It had to try and fund itself. It ultimately found that the only way to fund itself was to print more money. More and more money went into circulation. It became less and less valuable. Inflation took off. It happens so many times in Argentina. This is not the first time it's happened. It's happened again, and they've had to reset and reset and reset. Yeah. And every time they reset, it's the poor people that get screwed over. All the rich people have their money in property and hard assets and things like that. And the cycle continues. Mm. This is the problem. And why is Australia different? The short answer is we had better institutions.
Yep.
I mean, could they be better? Yes. But to me, this is, I mean, I don't want to pivot into where everyone is assuming I'm going to pivot.
But we were assuming.
This is the weakness. It's the best thing that we had up until recently, but was just the reliance on trust in our institutions. And institutions are full of people. People are fallible. They're weak-minded. They're gullible. They're naive. They're all the things that define the human condition that's as true to me and as to everyone else. And if they get it wrong, if an ideology takes over, if greed or corruption takes over, it ruins everything. Once the money breaks, I mean, that we call it inflation and we sort of focus too myopically on certain aspects of it. But the money breaks and then the society breaks around it. Here's something interesting. I mean, Argentina is not this weird fringe case. There's 160 fiat currencies out there. This is the normal scenario. You know, when you take away the US dollar, the euro, and like I think the top 10 currencies, I think all of them go through. Like the average survivability of a currency is something like 20 to 30 years before there is some kind of forced reset and capital controls and all of these very scary kinds of things, and ultimately reduced standard of living and inflation. Yeah. Just this week, Egypt gave up the ghost and just said, we're just going to let our currency free float on the market. And the whole thing collapsed. People's savings just evaporated overnight. Another country with poor institutions, poor controls. The money just got out of control. The money broke and everything else broke. What's interesting is when you go to these places, so you think, wait a second, that sounds very Mad Max kind of scenario. But anyone who's backpacked through those scenarios, like, you can still get a coffee. You can still get a room.
Yeah,
society still functions like badly, badly, and there's all kinds of impacts.
Yep.
But why does it function? Well, I'm sure the listener knows the answer. It's like they all use US dollars. Mm. It's called Gresham's Law. You know, when you've got alternate forms of money available to you, you will save in the hardest currency available to you, and you will get rid of as quickly as you can. If anyone pays you an Argentinian peso, I'm going to spend that right now because tomorrow it's going to be worth 20% less. And the wealthy, even if it's sort of the middle or upper middle class and above in those societies, they're holding things like Tether these days on their phones, and they've got US dollars stuffed under the mattress. If you're a doctor or someone of relatively high standing in those currencies, you can guarantee you there's a safe somewhere in that house full of physical paper US dollars. And that's how things survive. And again, it's much, 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 much worse for those at the bottom of the pile. But that's the only way it's sourced, because the market naturally seeks a better alternative. And yeah, it is a humanitarian tragedy, no less, is what I would say.
I think it's right, mate. I think I will say my view is it's slightly bigger than just the money. It's the institutions that go around, not just the cash, but the rule of law and other things that you know, sure. they cross over. They cross over money on the way through and back and all that.
Big overlap in the Venn diagrams, yeah, but exactly, yeah, totally. Exactly.
But yeah. Yes, that kind of idea. And by the way, can I just finish by saying a lot of luck? Because I would suspect that both times it's likely, I don't know the Argentinian history that well, but I suspect at some point it's likely that people thought they were doing the right thing, or maybe we're acting out of self-interest in both cases, but either way, that one's happened to work better than the other one. So in some cases, yes, we can look at absolutes and say we made these right choices or they made those bad choices. In other cases, like, well, hey, how about that? We thought we were doing the right thing, so did they, and we just got lucky.
Look at the Greeks.
Count luck.
Right? Like, yes. Everyone who works in the public, you should have a right to a comfortable retirement in thanks for your years of hard service. I mean, hey, hard to argue against all of that.
Yep.
But it's just like, you know, politicians miss the economic long-term reality of things. Like, that's great too, I agree, but we've got to fund it somehow. We need to balance the books. And it's when that distortion lasts, and it lasts for a long time, that's when you get to a point where it's sort of like the maths get, it's a tipping point, very, very much so, in the sense that you get to a point where there's actually not much you can do. Yep. And that's when you have Weimar Germany and the hyperinflation. It just goes like is happening in Egypt right now. Mm. It's like, well, what do we do? It's like trying to put out the fire with more gasoline, you know?
Yeah. And by the way, it's also why utopias don't work. And I kind of, you know, I'm a passionate defender of democratic capitalism, not because it's the best thing ever, because it's the least worst thing ever. And I mean literally ever. And so can it be improved? Yes. Should we improve it? Absolutely. When the this sucks, we should change it, we should blow this thing up. Or shout out to the modern monetary theorists out there. When you say we can just not worry about debt, or we can not worry about that, those are lovely sentiments. Yeah, thank you. That's a better word. They're lovely sentiments. And honestly, something like, we're not going to ignore it, but MNT could work in some forms managed appropriately.
The hyper-intelligent general AI.
Yes.
Would make it work.
Yes, or a benevolent dictator with no other vested interest. Sure, because
MMT is the same as communism. It's the same as central banking. That's it all rests on if you have the right people who are super smart and super generous and super egalitarian, then yes, yes, it will work. In any other real situation, no, it's going to fail miserably.
And so that's kind of, you know, I want to leave it with that point, mate, because it's, you know, it's. I get why people want the other things to be true, because it'd be lovely if it was. If communism could work, that'd be fantastic for everybody. Honestly, I'd be banging the drum, right? Because I'm some horrible red under the bed. No, because if everyone had enough, that'd be really nice. You know, I think we could all agree that prosperity and you know, a more equal sharing would be lovely.
Name one communist country that you want to move to today. I'll wait for you to answer, right?
And by the way, not just go there for a holiday because it looks nice for all, but actually stay there and deal with food shortages and medical treatment not available and all sorts of other things.
You don't want it.
Motley Fool Money. For more, subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener.
Sam has a very good and short question, mate. He simply says, "Good day, sirs. Can you please explain in layman's terms how that was speaking?" We've got prices in again. That's your front this time. "In layman's terms, how the market prices in interest rate cuts. I understand that bonds of varying maturity have different yields, but this statement I read so often in the media is not abundantly clear to me. And perhaps I'm not the only one. Thank you. Cheers, Sam." In brackets, "It may or may not be my real name." Just joking. Is it? Or is it? That is from Sam. So this is what I'm apparently, we think.
Could be a Samuel, or could be a Samantha. You don't know.
Well, exactly. It may just be Sam.
Yeah, could be.
How does the market price in interest rates, right?
So you've got to be aware of this two markets. There's the primary market, where the people who create the bonds, let's call them for what they are, IOUs. Here's an IOU, who wants it? I'll take it. Okay, in exchange, I'll promise to pay you these interest payments over the years, and then at the end of the period, I'll pay you all back. Great. Now that person's got it. Now that person can trade it on the secondary market. So it's just like, I didn't create the bond. I'm entitled to whatever benefits it represents, but I can give it to someone else for cash if I want to. And so if I've bought a bond off you and you've promised over the next 10 years to pay me 10% per year, but interest rates more broadly in the economy or whatever the central bank is doing, or, you know, just change, and I can now get 15% elsewhere, the same equivalent risk, I'll do that. And no one would buy my bond off me, right? So the only way I can make that compelling is to lower the price and therefore, because it's an inverse relationship, increase the yield. So it works backwards as well. You can, I don't know how the maths works. I'll put that out there right at the beginning. But you can do some maths to basically look at current bond pricing and infer what that says about expectations of interest rates.
Correct.
Because how those people price those interest rates in the secondary market is very much dependent on interest rates, because it's the opportunity cost. I've got this thing that's paying me a set amount, and there's another thing that's over there. And if I think that the general rates of the economy are going to increase significantly, well, I'm going to reflect that expectation by selling my bonds.
Right.
Yeah. Does that make sense?
It does.
I don't know how the math works. Maybe you can explain.
It's basically the calculation that says dollar value times interest rate equals payment, and you can if you reverse that, you can work out the interest rate. If you've got a certain payment, a certain dollar value of the asset, what's left is the implied interest rate.
Gotcha.
So I'm going to just add one more bit of color, Ram, to your answer, just to make it a bit clearer. If it wasn't clear already, it should be. But if it wasn't, when you buy a bond, you don't really buy a bond and get 5%. You buy a bond and you get a dollar value. Now that is a percentage by definition when you buy it, but that's why it can change. Because to Ram's explanation, I just want to add to that, mate, your explanation.
Yes.
Because
it's not a promise to pay 5%; it's a promise to pay $5 per coupon.
Right. So if I buy a $100 bond and I get $5, and then rates, because that's five, but that is 5%, right? We know that. If interest rates go to 10%, for example, right? I paid $100. I get $5 a year. But I can go and get, if I want to get $5 a year, I've only got to pay $50 now because I'm getting a 10% rate over there. So what does that do? My $5 a year payment is now only worth $50. And just to really slow that down for anyone who's doing the maths, if you get 10% anywhere else in the market and I want to sell my bond, who's going to buy it from me? Only someone who's getting what they could otherwise get in the market. Mm-hmm. If you get 10%, if Ram's offering you 10% and you get a $5 bond, you know, you're going to take that money. So what happens is the bond prices, the price of the, not the interest rate, but the price of the bond moves to make sure that the coupon rate, in other words, the $5, is a 10% return. And so that's when the bond prices will crash from 100 to 50 to represent the current prevailing interest rate, which is 10%. I know that's really, it's very, very hard to get your head around, very super hard to do it on audio, but hopefully that's given it some decent answer. So Ram's answer was exactly right, by the way. I just want to add the dollar value, because that's why they reprice, because you can't get more than 5% on your purchase price, but you can sell it for a lower price and increase the interest rate as a result, or the yield as a result.
The other thing to bear in mind is that these are the bets of people.
Yes, that's right.
You know, maybe sophisticated Wall Street traders or whatever, but those what the market is implying will change. Mm-hmm. So the mistake that you don't want to make is to say, oh, the market's implying that rates are going to do this over the year, and then take that as read. No, things change, and then the market will change, and then it'll apply a new one. It's a reasonable. All it tells you is, and this is where it's useful, is to say, well, what does the market think?
Yep.
The market thinks this. Now, my market might be completely wrong, but at least you know what it thinks by going through that process.
Yeah, great summary. And again, when we say the market, what we're really saying is just simply the price implied by everyone doing the trades. Mm. So you know, if everyone's saying, well, and sorry, just to finish that off, actually, Sam. How does it price it in? What it says is, hey, in future, we think the rates are going to go down. So we're going to buy or sell bonds at a price that assumes that's going to happen.
Yep.
So when we talk about it pricing in, again, Ram's summary was perfect. But looking forward, it says, well, rates are going to fall. So I'm going to pay less for that bond. Or I'll pay more for that bond, get a lower interest rate. And so when you talk about, so you might say a bond might mature in August 2024. We're recording this in early March. So if the rates are going to fall between now and then, the bond yield will fall, the price of the bond will go up. And so we can say, well, actually, traders are selling and buying August 2024 bonds with this implied yield. And that's how we talk about pricing in. They're basically allowed for the fact that at that point, they believe official rates will be lower. And so they're reflecting that in the prices they are paying for bonds that mature at that point. Hope that kind of finalizes it.
Yeah, and very quick segue. This is how so many of the US regionals got, and European banks for that matter, got into, and Chinese banks for that matter, got themselves into trouble, was they had a lot of capital tied up in bonds, and then interest rates spiked. Hmm. And so just what we discussed played out, it meant that all their bond portfolio on a mark-to-market basis, in terms of if they had to sell those bonds, they're carrying them on their balance sheet, you know, they're worth this much, but if they had to sell them, they'd be much, much lower. So technically insolvent for a lot of this. So the Fed Reserve had to come in with the BTFD, whatever it was, you know, emergency bailout. Let's call it what it is, a bailout. And now we actually saw it was a regional bank just folded this week, a similar kind of concept with exposure to commercial property over there, which is very much viewed and valued in the same way as bonds. Again, I've got this property, I'm paying so much rent, it gives me so much of a yield. Oops, all of a sudden interest rates change. Even if my capacity and occupancy and whatever doesn't sort of change, that opportunity cost analysis of what I can get elsewhere will impact the carrying value of that. And it can wipe people out, and does regularly, and in big institutions too. So
yeah,
that's gonna be interesting to play out. I mean, there's a lot of property developers in China whose bonds aren't worth the paper they're printed on. You know, it's a very, you got to remember, there's always another party to the trade. Someone's losing here somewhere.
Correct. I have my issues with marking to market for the purposes of doing that, but that's a whole different conversation. We'll probably leave for
another time. It is a different one, yeah.
Mate, Kate, a female listener. Thank you, Kate, for sending in a question. She says, hi, Scott and Andrew. When I was in my 20s, I invested in Macquarie-managed funds. This bought our first house. Fast forward 30 years, and I am now newly divorced. Well, sorry to hear that, Kate. I've invested in Macquarie Australian shares and Macquarie small companies with the vision to hold for 7 years. I am also waiting for a term deposit to mature to invest in the Vanguard Global ETF. Should I sell my funds and invest that money in these ETFs? Have managed funds lost their mojo? I know the fees are higher, but surely you're paying for a specialized service. I know you don't give financial advice, but in all the podcasts I listen to, you only mention ETFs, which I only heard about 4 months ago. Keep potting on. From avid listener Kate, she describes herself as. She's in my neck of the woods too, so good, Kate. Thank you for your question. Great question, mate. Why do we not talk about managed funds? And what should we think about when we're comparing an ETF against a managed fund?
Yeah, it always ruffles a few feathers, but you've got to remember we can only speak generally.
Yes.
And this is just unequivocal. I don't think it shouldn't be a controversial statement, but you know, when you look at the sector at large, it tends to underperform the index and tends to underperform low-cost passive ETFs because of the fees. Kate's absolutely right. I mean, the promise is that we'll do better than the market after fees. And credit where it's due, there are funds out there that have done that. And that's no guarantee that they will continue to do that. Look at Magellan. You know, there's a whole bunch of examples that are sort of there. But that's the hard part of it. I think if you can have, and I don't know how you build a lot of confidence in this other than it's like someone with an incredibly impeccable record. But if you sincerely believe that you can pay the extra fees and still outperform, then yeah, it's a perfectly rational decision. The advantage, I suppose, of the ETFs is that as we said in the previous answer along these lines, is you're taking it out of the equation. The bet is what will outperform, goes from what will outperform the market to just give me the market.
Yeah.
So it's a different kind of calculus. So it's sort of like that's there for free, for want of a better term, as far as a free lunch you can kind of get that you can choose from the buffet. But if you've got confidence that actually this is another alternative, I can do better. In the same way as you might think I can do better directly in a share, or in Bitcoin or whatever, you know, a property, doesn't matter. Whatever alternatives that I've got out there, can I do better? So I tend to think, given the track record, and this, you might have some stats at hand, I don't know, Scott, but like it's not like 51% outperform and 49% underperform type thing. It's sort of like 70% of active fund managers underperform after fees or even
after fees. I think it's closer to 80 or 85% most years. It depends on the year, it depends on the fund, and depends on how they're choosing to actively manage, what strategy they're following. But yeah, it tends to be about those numbers, mate. And this is why, Kate, it's a tough one. People, we all kind of tend to default our own experience. So if you've invested in a managed fund that's done well, you're like, man, managed funds are amazing. Look at what I got for the money. And if you've done badly, managed funds suck and that's terrible. Our approach generally, and as Ram says, we can't give you personal advice, but our approach generally is that you want to put the odds in your favor. And if you said to me, I've got a bet for you. You can invest in a managed fund, but 4 out of 5 of them will lose. Do you want to roll the dice on that? I'm like, well, hang on. If I buy one, there's an 80% chance I'm going to get the wrong one. If I invest in 5 of them, one might outperform. It doesn't mean you have to. The odds don't always work out at an individual level. Maybe you pick 3 out of the 5 that outperform. Maybe you only buy one and that does outperform. And you think, wow, I'm a genius. I picked the right one. The hardest part is knowing which ones are going to. Now, by the way, the Motley Fool picks stocks for a living. I would say the same about our industry as about managed funds, which is we say we are going to try and beat the market if you would like us to help you do that. And we either do it or we don't. And so far, so good for ShareAdvisor. I've been running that for, 12 years now. Time goes fast. We're having fun. We're beating the market, which is great. And I, by the way, terms and conditions, blah, blah, blah. Past performance, no guarantee. But we could have easily been losing to the market. Others in our space will be currently losing to the market. Now, that's fine. In fact, one of our services is, actually, by the way. So there you go. Just to be really honest up front. That's the choice you make, as Ram says. You either choose to get the market return less a tiny fee, or you try and beat the market, knowing you could lose to the market instead. And that's why I love ETFs. And it's why, honestly, I don't love managed funds, generally speaking, because if you've got a great fund manager who has a great track record, Warren Buffett's company that owns shares in Berkshire Hathaway is effectively a closed-end managed fund, right? Because you're investing in his investment wisdom, his ability to allocate money and beat the market with that company. That's exactly what you're doing. Now, if you're Buffett and you're investing with Buffett, I'm pretty happy with that. If it's Jane Bloggs and she's been doing it for 3 years, or the fund's been open for 10 years, but they have 3 different fund managers during that time, how much confidence do I have that Jane or John Bloggs is going to beat the market? And should I have that confidence? When I always say people, how much confidence do you have? Oh, lots. I say, and so it's the wrong question. What I say is, how much confidence should you have based on the evidence? And if your answer is still lots, because here's what's happened, and this fund manager ran it 15 years, they've done this, they've done that, and this is why they're great, then I'm happy to say, well, probabilistically, if they've got a special source, then go for it. But to Ram's point, if 4 out of 5 of them don't, then the odds aren't great. And that's why ETFs are so fantastic. I am a massive fan. Now, to be very clear, as I've said many times, I'm talking specifically about that subset of ETFs, which are the super low cost, broadly diversified, index-based ETFs, right? The Vanguard ASX 300 ETF, or the, I think it's a BlackRock ASX 200, an S&P 500 ETF, or a Vanguard Global ETF. I think they're wonderful things. I own some of those. Not all of them, I own some of them. By the way, I can't influence the price because the market maker sets the price based on the asset value, so it doesn't matter if I mention it or not, but for full disclosure, I always do. So I think ETFs are great. I don't have no view on the Macquarie managed funds, by the way, Kate, at all. I haven't looked at them, haven't studied them. Are they going to beat the market in the next 5 years? Don't know. But if I knew I could get the market return 5 years with effectively zero risk, or as close to zero risk as you can get, and with a really tiny fee, would I back? By definition, the average managed fund doesn't beat the market. So almost again, by definition, there's your answer. If you wanted to maximize your chance of getting the average return, you would go with an ETF. And that's why I love them. That's why I talk about them a lot. That's why I recommend them to people if they are looking for a hands-off investment. If the fund manager is going to beat you, then so that's great. Or beat the market, sorry. But if they're not, or you don't know, then I would say if you're not sure if you're going to beat the average, go with the average, because at least you know you're going to get that one.
Nice.
Should we finish with a property question, Ram?
Sure.
I did promise a Bitcoin question. I'm not going to get there.
It's the question
after next, but we might have to hold that over next week. I'm scrolling. It's right here. Hi, Scott and Ram, says Anonymous. This one for you, mate. Mike, it's not Bitcoin, but it's close. My question is, what are your thoughts on house prices hitting a ceiling? I think I know Ram's thoughts, LOL, but can you tell me what I'm missing? If most people get a loan from a bank to buy, then wouldn't wages dictate home prices? Say, for instance, most people's wages only allow them to borrow $1 million, then how can house prices keep going up without real wage growth? Also, it seems like investors have already priced in future gains into their current purchase prices, because anyone who purchased in the last few years are cash flow negative. He says loan repayments, maintenance, etc. are way higher than the rent. Even people renting can only pay so much before it's unaffordable, so how can rents keep rising? I've heard it all, says our questioner. Supply and demand, houses always go up, you can't lose on property. But unless wages go up, how can people pay more? With most businesses struggling, with inflation and productivity low, how can businesses pay higher wages? It seems to me we pull every lever we can to push them to a peak. And our questioner lists dual income, unemployment at record lows, negative gearing, immigration at a record high, banks squeezing every bit of borrowing capacity, and no real recession in 30 or 40 years. Apart from inheritance, how is the average Australian going to break into the market? I really can't wrap my head around how it is going to keep going up. Thank you for your time, Anonymous.
Easy. So people will desire this thing, obviously. There's a huge and unending demand for it. There's limited supply. So that's what the bulls will point to, and they're dead right to do that. So it provides a very big floor. But ultimately, if you're expecting prices to increase, and let's be specific here, increase beyond a rate of inflation. So increase in real terms, in value, on a net basis after management costs and fees and taxes, which, I mean, why wouldn't you include that, right? You need to have, well, three things. The first is wages. So Anonymous is 100% right. But what I missed, and I think a lot of people missed, was the proportion of our wages we're happy to spend on housing. The Green senator made the point in their press club rant the other day, which was excellent, by the way, that, you know, when Anthony Albanese bought his place in Marrickville, it was 5 times the average wage. Hmm. You know, the same house, well, not specifically the same house, but the same type of house in the same suburb is 20 times income. Yeah. So incomes have grown, yeah, but They've not grown anywhere near the degree of house prices. And that's just it. We have elected to people who are buying, whoever, probably because they were forced to, frankly, because of the supply, the lack of supply, just said, you know, a previous generation said, I think five times my salary is what I can afford to bear. And that's just what we sort of went with. And now it's 20 times in some places and more. So you've got to ask yourself, oh, and the third prong is access to credit. And that's a big part of the longer arc of the property bubble, if I can call it that, which is we just had much easier access and much lower cost of finance that was available to us. So when we were cashed up, and able to we were earning well, we hadn't had a recession for ages, more people are in the house are working, and we've just decided that, well, if we want a house, I guess we just have to pay 10 times our income. And I remember having chats with you, mate, when it was 10 times average income, going, this is so unsustainable. Mathematically, it is, right? Like, I stand by the statement. Well, what I think is surprising was that it's gone to 20. Now, does that mean it can't go to 30? No, it could go to 4. I don't know. At some point it caps out, right? Like, and that's the point that I want to underscore with Anonymous is that, you can't go... You can go to 100%. Well, you can't even go to 100% because you've got to eat and there are other things that you need in life, right? You can all get massive pay rises, but that is going to assume insane levels of productivity boosting that probably not reliable and an extension of credit, which is still possible, particularly if rates come down. But let's not forget the bank's balance sheets are all like at least 3/4 of associated with residential property. Every man and his dog is up to the eyeballs in debt. It's like, well, yeah, you know, you're going to have to really make the debt better. And this is the path they're going. It's like we're now having 40-year mortgages and intergenerational mortgages and cross-collateralized sort of mortgages. I think that you can make a very objective statement that just, well, I don't know when or how, but that is unsustainable. I think that is true. It is a different thing, and people usually jump to this. Oh, so you think property's all going to crash tomorrow? I was like, well, it could, but I'm not shorting housing, right? I don't think it's a lock. I'm certainly not that silly to do it. It could get crazier still. And this is the thing you always learn about bull markets and in bear markets, whether it's shares or property or whatever, is the gains can always go. You can look at the share and think this is insane, right? Like, we've talked about this with ProMedicus before. It's like, great company. It's like, my God, at $60, it felt like just like eye-wateringly expensive. And it got much more expensive, you know? And when things drop, you think, oh, how much further can it go? Well, it can keep going, right? And I think that's the observation that needs to be made here is that when I just bought a house, right? Like, so I get it, right? But if you're predicating things on faster than system, faster than inflation, real after costs gains, then you have to implicitly have a view on one of those three factors: credit, wages, or the proportion of wages that's thrown to it. And then in all cases, the net impact of all of the whatever assumptions used has to be that's going to allow people to bid up to higher prices. Because without that, I mean, I'm all ears. What else happens without that? And it doesn't mean a crash, mind you. Maybe like Alan Kohler says, it just goes sideways for a long time. I suspect that's probably likely because of the demand is so strong. But I don't get it either. And I'll say you also for the record, as much as I poo-poo property, if I could buy a house that gave me a net yield 4 or 5%, and I could do it without stretching myself to the utter limit where I'm living on 2-minute noodles just to sort of make repayment, like, I'd do it in a heartbeat. Like, it's an incredible investment. Like, who's critical of that? It's the criticism comes from the person who's actively gushing cash out the door on this belief that this thing will compound at 7, 8, 9, 10% per annum for the foreseeable future. And maybe it will, and they'll do very well if it does, but maybe it won't. And it doesn't have to be a 30% crash. It just needs to be, oh no, it only grew at 3% per annum over the last 5 years and all I've done is bleed cash. And if I sell now, I might walk away break even on a nominal basis. I think a lot of people are facing, recent investors, I think that's what they're staring down, frankly.
Yeah, I think that's right, mate. And that's where we need to be a little bit careful with our language. You talk about unsustainable. I think you mean the prices are not necessarily unsustainable. The growth from here is unsustainable. Is that
right there? I mean, trees don't grow to the sky. I mean, prices could just stay flat. But, I mean, you just do the logical mental exercise of pick a number. I don't know. Go 10%.
Yep.
Well, you roll that forward fast enough and the Australian property market is bigger than global GDP at a point. You know, maybe that's 100 years off. But my point is that the trajectory is clearly unsustainable.
Yep. No, for sure. And for what it's worth, I completely 100% agree with that. I think the impact of all of those things you've highlighted are exactly the right issues, the right questions, the right concerns. You've got to start by saying we are in a position where those things seem to be relatively maxed out. Doesn't mean they can't go up, but the rate of growth, the things that got us here won't get us there. Mm-hmm. The house prices for centuries went up roughly the rate of wages until the late mid-70s, something like that. And then like the 40 years after that, they went relatively vertical. The growth was astonishing. And it was because of all the things that you've exactly talked about with your question, Anonymous. The availability of credit, second incomes, bank loan-to-value valuation ratios, interest rates themselves, all those things compounded to push prices higher. Frankly, one of the biggest ones is just second incomes in households, which is, for everything else we talk about the cost of money, the 5x income to 10x income, well, if you go from 5x1 income to 5x2 incomes, you get to 10x income. So it's not even a surprise that when second incomes have been applied to paying off mortgages, that has increased prices. It almost should have by definition. Now, in a perfect world, we'd all be smart enough to say, let's actually use that second income for things other than capitalizing in the house prices. But we didn't as a group. And there's no one made us do those things, by the way. We all chose to outbid each other at auction, either directly at auction or the slow moving auction that is the perpetual sales process of housing. We could have all just said, no, we're going to stick with 5x1 income. Thanks. And that would have changed what happened. So no one made us do that. But that's how you get to here. Which is fine, but unless you have a third income in a household, unless interest rates go negative, unless banks want to lend you 110% of the value, but again, you've still got to pay it back. So you do the maths on that. You could maybe, cut back on Netflix and put an extra $10 a month into the repayments. But at some point, that just stretches far enough and doesn't have to snap back. It just can't keep growing at that rate. I think wages will keep going up. That's the only thing I would take a slight, not exception to, but you talk about productivity, and you're right, it's low productivity. I think it's really unlikely we don't have, let me put it positive, I think it's very likely wages continue to grow. So house prices will continue to grow in all likelihood over time. Doesn't mean they won't fall. In the meantime, it's never a straight line. But if wages compound at 2, 3, 4%, then it's not unreasonable. Property would do something similar, almost by definition, without any of those other things needing to change, which is kind of exactly your point when you ask about what else can be different. But that's just what you would expect, right? Rents go up because people can afford to pay more rent. Prices go up because people can afford to pay more on property. But again, as a portion of income, they don't become any less or more affordable. They just all go up at the same rate of wages, which is fine. But there's no wealth being meaningfully created in that process.
That is the longer-term driver. I think whenever I've read a study of very, very long-term trends in prices, whether it comes from Amsterdam going back to the 1600s or various other places around the world, it tends to match wage growth. And it makes sense, right? Like it just sort of, it doesn't, this is where so many people go wrong when they say, I only paid this much back in 19-dickety-doo or whatever it was. The way that just standardizes that to make it a more realistic comparison is like, how many years of labor did I have to give up for this asset? And that is people will have a changing propensity sort of over time. But that's the only, if anyone's familiar with physics, there's all the different forces, the strong nuclear force, the weak nuclear force, electromagnetism, gravity. They're all like very different. But, at close distances, it's all about the sort of, the other forces. At larger distance, the only thing that matters is gravity. I would say wage growth is the gravity of property markets writ large when you look at decade long sort of timescales, which again is sort of points to like just a moderation of expectation, I think, for a lot of people, given that the other levers of proportion of income and credit have already been pulled so tight. You're right, mate. I agree with you. Wages will continue to grow and that will be a underlying gravitational pull for property. Yep. But wages ain't growing at 7% per annum, let me tell you that right now. Correct. So.
And even if they do, the relative wealth that gets created is still, the wealth creation is only worth it if it grows it faster than wages. Otherwise, it's effectively the same thing.
Yep.
The dollar value of what you can buy with that money, assuming other prices go up at the same rate, if wages go up at 3%, property goes up at 3%, price go up at 3% on everything else we can buy with the money, it's kind of the same. At some point, it nets out to the same thing. You end up in roughly the same spot. It's the days of oversized gains. I won't say they're over because who knows, as Ram says. The way we got here is relatively logical. Might it be overly rational as choices as a society? If we'd all got together as a group and said, here's what we should do, we all go, that's stupid, let's not do that. But we did. And so the way we got here is rationally explainable and logically estimable, and you can almost do the math working. In fact, I did the math once for a Motley Fool article. I kind of literally got the piece of paper out, went, okay, well, if incomes have gone up by this much, and you know, female participation's gone up by this much, and rates have gone down by that much, that's roughly what you should expect. And it was very back of the envelope, but I got really close to the average increase in prices, which is fine. But then you ask yourself, which one of those is going to continue to grow from here? As I said, short of third incomes, or you know, in a household, send the kids to the salt mines. There's only so much more that can push prices higher, meaningfully, sustainably, for an extended period of time.
Yep, nailed it.
Can we hold the Bitcoin question over till next week, Ram? Is that gonna, are you gonna?
Well, next week we're at an all-time high now, and I just know that it being what it is, that that opportunity will pass by next week. So I'm reluctantly grip my teeth and say, okay.
quick anecdote: I was on Twitter. And one of those Twitter spaces came up saying, Bitcoin hits all-time high, what's next? And I literally went across to the Bitcoin share price chart on Google. Bitcoin price on Google was down 7.5%. I couldn't resist. I was like, oh, guys, you literally asked for that. What next? It fell.
Do you know what's super frustrating? Like, the darn thing's up like 200% over the last year. Like, absolute zero from the mainstream media.
Yeah.
It touches an all-time, it's well over an all-time high in Aussie dollar terms and that's British true. Pounds and the rest of it. But in the US dollar, it kind of got there, and then it had an 8% sell-off.
Yeah,
and then everyone's writing articles about it. It's like, hang on, can we have a little bit of context? You know. And by the way, as I speak to you now, that dip is gone. I'm not trying to make any nice. Point of it, but it's funny the bias of it. It's just sort of like, not interesting, not interesting. Oh, wait a second, this aligns with our prejudice. Well, let's report that. You know, it's so funny.
To be fair, it's the same as $40 billion wiped off the market. They don't write the $40 billion wiped off the market articles either. It's something about the media and losses, and we like car crashes, don't we?
Yeah, crypto crashing. It's just got, people are going to click on that. You know, it's sort of like, turns out that this thing's got massive adoption. Wall Street's here. It's going to, you know, all-time highs in every country. But hey, that's not of interest. It blows my mind. But anyway.
I'm sure you can hold on that frustration for another 7 days, Ram. It's not new for you.
Yeah, exactly. You were very smart not to raise it earlier in the podcast, because that's all we would have talked about.
Oh, no. Literally, I kid you not, mate. I'm looking at my list of questions. Literally, the next question on my list. I looked at the time and went, if I start this now, I'm here for another 20 minutes.
You're right.
Not probably better
20,
for all of
20
us.
Minutes if you're lucky. Yeah, exactly.
All right, mate. Well, can you come back on Friday and we'll talk about Bitcoin next week?
If you say that, I'll move heaven and earth to be back here.
That's how we keep him on the hook, listeners. Until next Friday, have a great weekend and fool on.
Cheers.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.